It's the Let's Go Eat and Drink Show with hosts Jimmy Santangelo and Bill Allred. Let's go. I'm your announcer, Zach Caton, and we're coming to you live, on tape, from Cassatt in the heart of 15th and 15th. Cassatt, a wine and craft cocktail bar at 1508 South, 1500 East in the Great Salt Lake City. Our Let's Go Eat guest today is the founder of Pago Restaurant Group, Scott Evans.
Something new on the horizon? Yes, what are you planning?
This will be the first official words in on air in the media at all, so...
The Pago Group includes Pago on 9th, Finca, Pago on Main, Emigration Cafe, and of course, Cassatt. And now here's your hosts, Jimmy and Bill.
Thank you very much, Zach. Zach Caton, or is it Catton, our announcer.
Is it Kitten?
I don't know. I heard him say his name in the intro, and I thought, oh, I think I've been saying it wrong. But we're here on the Let's Go Eat Show, Bill Allred and Jimmy Santangelo, with our special guest, as Zach mentioned. Scott Evans, who is the founder, the proprietor of the Pago Restaurant Group. Scott we're graciously being hosted here at Cassatt, which is not your latest project, or is it the most recent?
It is the pretty close timing. I think this is actually the latest project.
Yeah, this is kind of. Yeah. But there's one in that we'll talk about in a minute.
One in the hopper.
Scott Evans started. You started with Pago.
Yep. At the 9th location.
One of the first farm to table restaurants in the city.
Mm. When was that?
2009.
Mm. I'm going to ask you this right now. Why did you do that? I ask everybody or anybody who's in the restaurant business, you got to ask them.
He's going to need a glass of wine to answer this. So we're going to pour.
All right. I'll have a glass as well. But why does anybody want to get into this business?
Yeah. I mean, there is that point where, and I guess you can do the math and figure out how old I am now, but I was at the age where I had kind of, career was going pretty well at a young age, and I was starting to manage some good restaurants and had some good experience behind me. Mm-hmm. And I was on the cusp of I always knew I wanted to open a business, became a restaurant 10 years in my mind before I opened one. But then I got to the point where I was making decent money managing. It's like, I either need to move out of state and work in a big market. I was considering New York City and try to apprentice, learn from the best. Or do I stay in Salt Lake and get a business degree and learn how to write a request for money?
Yeah.
So I ended up.
I knew how to run the business.
How to get a loan?
How do you get the bread?
How do I raise money? So in the end, it's a long process, but it took 2 or 3 years to get the MBA, get the business degree, learned how to got a little bit better at running businesses on the financial side, and. Yeah, it was all passion and psychosis at the same time. But at that point, I felt there's lots of things that Salt Lake needed from my perspective. I had family in New York and D.C. My dad lived in L.A. my whole life. I've just traveled all over the world, backpacking, skateboarding, hitchhiking, snowboarding. And I was doing that while I was working in restaurants, raising a bunch of money, traveling, coming back, working in restaurants. So after 15-plus years of doing most every job, I've never been a chef, but... I've prepped some vegetables. And
How to uncork a bottle of wine.
Yeah. No, all front of the house is most of my experience, but that was kind of that time. And the time for that particular concept, it was when people didn't know what the word farm to table meant.
Was this 1990, you say?
No, 2009.
2009.
Yeah. Yep, 2009. And the farmer's market was blowing up. And so it gave me hope that my concept worked. And it was really just... things that I loved from my travels of Europe. It's just food that was featured peak season. You make everything in house. It's homemade, simple food and a really good wine program. Cause that was where I started hanging my hat pretty early in my career that's what I wanted to be good at and learn and study. And I inherited the wine program at the Grand America in 2004, right after the Olympics. And it was a pretty amazing list because it was post Olympics and we had no idea what we were doing with it. so we were like, we need to study and figure out what's on here. Cause all these consultants built this amazing list and now we have to sell it. and no one was.
Was it just a list, or was there actual? There was product as well.
Huge inventory.
Yeah.
Huge inventory.
And, yeah, big wine program. So Scotty had to manage it and make the update the wine list and educate staff, but educate yourself.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, what the heck do we have here?
How did
after the Olympics.
How did you find somebody to be a chef that you say, I want to do farm to table? How did you find the person to do that?
Yeah. I mean, it's a good question because it's not the same way I go about it now. So at that time, I had, just from working in restaurants, I asked every chef I knew for, you know, who's ready for this job. I want someone who hasn't done it before, so we do it together. And I also needed to be able to afford them.
Mm-hmm.
So it couldn't be a 10-year veteran experienced chef because, frankly, that just was out of the budget. So I wanted someone with experience outside of the market that had that saw the vision and it wasn't foreign to them. So they were excited about the products that we wanted to feature. So I literally wrote a product list and said, I want to feature these products, and they're all farmers market products. And then I talked to chefs and did several tastings, which is a fun part of interviewing people.
Yeah.
They cook for you, write a menu and cook for you and do a couple other things like cost out the menu and stuff. And then I found Mike Ritchie. So he's the chef of Wildwood. He was the opening chef at Pago. And that came from a recommendation from Adam
Kreisel. Yeah.
Oh, I know that
from
name.
Culinary school.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Yeah. So they went to culinary school in San Francisco, worked in the Bay Area for quite a while together, and that's that's how we connected. Had never
what
met.
What an organic way to do it. Yeah. You know, to say this is what I wanna to create. These are the ingredients. Are you comfortable with them?
Yeah.
And do you see a vision, or can we at least share and build a vision together with it? That takes some vulnerability and some willingness on the part of a chef and yourself. That's unique, man. That's
it was a bit now that I've been doing this for, you know, owning for 15 years. It was pretty bold of me to tell the chef what ingredients they're cooking with. And I'm like, hey, it is my investment, but guess what? This is
my vision. Can you help me with it?
Yeah. And I actually got in trouble a handful of times by two chefs because it was so uncommon for a front of the house person or a sommelier to own a restaurant. I was often misquoted in papers as the chef, even though I never said it once out loud.
I seem to remember reading things of that nature.
In the paper,
chef owner.
Yeah. City Weekly, Salt Lake Tribune, chef owner, Scott Evans. I'm like, ooh, I'm going to be in a lot of trouble when I get to the
restaurant.
Richie's
not going to be happy.
So they all gave me a lot of trouble after
that. Well, let's raise a glass in that case.
Yeah, what is this wine, by the way?
It's a white wine. It's Puy Fumé. It's basically Sauvignon Blanc out of the Loire Valley, specifically the Puy Fumé. Scotty's familiar with this. This is by the son of Dia de Dagano, Jean-Claude Dagano, which is famed producer. He's passed away since. Silex is, I've only had that a couple of times. Cheers, fellas.
Cheers.
It's very good. Very good. I like it. When did you... So Pago starts rolling along, and... Or maybe you can't even say this today, but when did you think, okay, I got this. This is working. This is going to be a success. I feel pretty damn solid.
I guess it would be the... Restaurants never really give you that feeling for very long.
That's what I was thinking.
They remind you of. Yeah.
You have moments where you're like, this is amazing. People are coming. And I remember the first time that actually I probably felt that is when I was able not to be there on one of the services.
When you don't have to close.
So I you know, it was something that I still do to this day, but I don't have the same feelings. But we would, every time I'd leave at like 8 or 9 or I took a day off and it was, I would drive by the restaurant 100 times.
Just like,
are people in there? Do they look happy? And every time I'd drive by and I'd see
run a product mix mid-shift. Let me see where we're at.
That literally was very satisfying knowing that, you know, something that I had created with others, of course, but something that was an idea of mine became a reality and people came and they spent money and they believed in. It's kind of in service in general. There's a point where you kind of have to act a little bit. You act like you know everything about the menu and you're so comfortable and there you.
I do that with radio.
You end up believing.
You get there one day, kid.
You end up believing yourself eventually, and that's kind of.
There are some inspirations about service and hospitality. Do you have any that? I know you just peeked at the book.
No, I already know. Yes.
Does this book look familiar to you? Tethered as mine?
Yes. Yep. No,
what
Danny
is the
Meyer
book?
Is the legend. He's honestly, he was also
how, she the guy who did Shake Shack?
Yes. Yeah. Yep.
Danny
yeah.
Meyer, this is
Setting the Table.
Setting the Table, yeah. Great book. I think that's my third copy, and it's even beat all to hell. Something that just inspires you. Mm. I take that when I travel, take it on plane, just to keep my head in the game. Mm. And over COVID, there was a pushback with Danny Meyer in the New York Times. Some restaurants have changed. Restaurants have changed, and the customer's not always right. How can you make everything better than the last time? Like, hey, after a while, this is what we do at the restaurant. You like it or you don't. We're trying our hardest, believe me, kind of a thing.
Did it help that Pago's a pretty, there's not a lot of tables there, pretty it was, intimate. Was that helpful? Just
That was the idea, is I didn't think the concept was big yet. I knew it would be, I'd be building a small audience. And that really was probably one of the better decisions that I made, as I found at the time in 2009, and people probably will forget this, there were very few small restaurants. Everywhere I looked, it was a 100-plus seat restaurant, and I knew that it was bigger and more expensive than I needed for my concept. I think that helped a lot of the smaller fine dining places or elevated food places see that you could do that, and it reduces your costs, reduces your labor, and it just it makes it a little bit better vibe for the guest. And I've kind of been a small restaurant guy in general. There's only a few examples of my larger spaces, but I think in fine dining style, food a little more elevated, you know, more expensive price per plate. It helps in this market, which is still it's a growing market. We're not there yet, 100%, but especially on the higher end. I needed that size. I needed 50 seats or under was the math I was looking
for.
And
it feels busy. It'll always feel busy.
I remember the first time I went in there, and I was just thrilled. It was just, I like it because it's not noisy.
Yeah.
You know, it's you can have a conversation with your dining partners, and that's, I really like that. So, and where does the name come from, Pago?
So Pago is one of my dorky Spanish wine words. When I was studying for one of my first certifications before I opened Pago, there was a new Spanish wine term, and I love Spain. That's why I think it exists. I spend a lot of time there and travel there about at least once a year. Sometimes it happens to be every other year. But they had, in that time period when I was opening, they had a new wine designation term. They called it DO, and it was called DO Pago. And DO Pago was translated into outstanding wines grown outside of an established wine growing region. And for me, I related that directly to what I was trying to do with restaurants. I wanted to have an outstanding restaurant that would be outstanding anywhere in the country, but happens to be in a smaller market. And the other, you know, subtle words of it, Pago also means farm in Castilian. So it means small farm, small plot. You're seeing a little bit more on wine labels now. Same with Finca, just to tie that in. Finca is the same thing. Oh. The meaning's the same.
Oh, okay.
Not the DO part, but the farm component.
Farm part.
It means small personal plot. So you'll see it on small boutique wine projects from Spain. You'll see Finca and Pago on there because it's term of endearment for their
Even Casat. Casat has meaning behind it.
Yeah, so Finca was the next.
Finca was the next, 2012.
Next project. And then where did we go? And tell people where Finca is located.
Finca has a new lovely home. Forget about the last two before this one. This is where it should always have been. But it's on, people remember Fresco because it was a great restaurant.
I ate there many times. It was really good.
Yeah. It's a 30-year home of Fresco. We had Trestle Tavern in there. But during the pandemic, that was one of the shuffles of many things for myself and for my group, and I missed Finca, and I thought that location and the atmosphere was perfect, so I did another insane thing and opened a restaurant for the third time in a third location.
That is kind of odd, isn't it?
You know, your menu board in the front, and that's how I put that up. That was me when I was when I was GM of Fresco, when we with Billy Sotelo leading behind the grill. Yeah,
nice. And there's a Pago on Main Street.
It's about 2 years old now,
and then we're sitting here at Casat.
Casat. Yeah.
Now, it's an interesting concept, I think. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should just touch on the Immigration Cafe just quickly before we go get to Casat. Tell tell us about the Immigration Cafe.
Immigration Cafe, one, it's not in Immigration Canyon. I've confused people, and I apologize for that. It's across the street from Immigration Market, and it's right on the corner of Immigration Street, which is also where I live. So that's what the meaning of the name is.
Sandy.
Yeah, the market. The market has
They're
such a big...
They're searching in Immigration Canyon.
This isn't... They're like, we're... you know, and yeah, so that was the name. It really was intended to be a neighborhood cafe. Mm-hmm. And East Liberty Tap House, which was mine and I sold, was the same idea where you know, that's that name of that neighborhood is mm-hmm. East Liberty.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so same idea with Immigration. We wanted to be a place for the neighborhood to dine. So part of that was breakfast, lunch, and dinner. We're open a lot. There's a coffee shop in there from Logos Coffee, that little micro roaster that's doing a great job. So it was really just to be the catch-all, delicious, fresh food. It's our most casual concept, but we still have, you know, fine dining quality made from scratch, at farm to table, everything still, but it's just a broader menu. So, you know, the other restaurants, you won't have a sandwich or a salad for an entree. You could do that at Immigration. Mm. And so you could have a choice from like a $12 to a $30 entree mm-hmm. for dinner. Mm-hmm. Most lunches are around like $15.
So let's go. Okay, now let's come to Cassatt, where we're mm-hmm. sitting right yep. now, 15th and 15th. Mm-hmm. It's a wine bar and a craft cocktails as well.
Yep.
And just talk a little bit about the name and the concept. And
yeah. What. So, I mean, we officially said wine work. My partner, James, he wanted... Yeah, another shift of everyone else. Everyone was downsizing for the office. So the daytime, it's an office space, which kind of is unrelated to the evening enterprises here, but it's worth mentioning. Mm-hmm. And that's why we get to hang out here today, because mm-hmm. we're not open as a bar yet. But essentially, what I've always wanted and what I loved about everywhere I've been outside of Utah is neighborhood everythings, including bars. And the laws in Utah have... you know, slowly, but, you know, occasionally changing. Mm-hmm. And this zoning, it's all based on the community council and zoning laws, allowing you to open in certain neighborhoods. Prior to East Liberty Tap House, neighborhoods were not zoned for bars. So we were the first neighborhood bar when we opened that. And then they added 15th and 15th as part of that zoning plan. Mm-hmm. But the challenges to open a bar... the way it works with the DABS, and you're required to have a lease, and the waiting list has always been about 9 months to a year. So it's kind of prohibitive for people to find a space, pay for it for a year before you might be able to open as a bar.
Ridiculous, isn't it?
And there's also community council. You have to do public hearings. It's just, you know, there's a lot of roadblocks. So
I think that's that'll change. That'll change sometime in the near future, I think.
I hope so. Yeah. But knowing the process once through the Tap House, and having the situation where that we just timed the space right, where the building wasn't going to be done in 9 months. So we got on the list. That's part of why I had the office in the day, is like, well, if we don't ever get a bar license, we can at least be an office and my partner can work out of here.
Yeah.
But that was the logistic side and why there's not more neighborhood bars. But for me, I wanted to do a neighborhood bar that represented this neighborhood, 15th and 15th, that was a bit more casual. It feels like an old world tavern. I don't really care for super polished, fancy,
chrome,
modern,
and,
you know, cold,
sleek.
Yeah, cold wine bars, because mm-hmm. I think wine's like potentially stuffy enough. I like to make it more fun. So I want to serve really fancy wines in a very casual, comfortable setting. And that was the idea, and then I scored this beautiful bar.
Yeah, talk about this. This is great. Just a beautiful thing. Where did this bar come from?
So this bar came out of a restaurant that Mark Eaton and Larry H. Miller had in Sandy, and it was called Cantina, but there was another Italian name before. But Mark Eaton fell in love with this bar, and his wife came in and vouched for most of the story, because everything's like lore. I'm telling a story. There's no written history of this, but so she vouched for some of it when the Tribune mentioned it. But essentially, it's a 100-year-old bar that he had shipped from Italy, I believe from Milan, and put into that, you know, it's a strip mall. It was a strip mall restaurant. So
Mark
like,
Eaton saw this bar in Milan and has somehow it came up for sale.
Yeah. And well, he paid to get it shipped here to Utah. Mm. It was sitting in this restaurant. It had been closed for 6 years. And I get people that just ask me if I want to buy anything from restaurants when they close. So mm-hmm. I randomly will walk through. I saw this bar. I said, I want it. Don't sell it to anyone else. And then I'll pay a deposit when they need me to, but I don't have a place for it. So for 2 years, I just sat on this bar. I had no home for it. I just fell in love with it. I was like, this is hard to match the feel. And just thinking of how many hundreds of years of elbows sitting on this countertop. And, you know, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
We do wipe it, so it's still clean. But
100-year-old elbow germs.
Yeah.
Elbow frosted grime on bugs. It.
Yeah.
Looks great. Is it, and is this all, what is that, that material on the front kick panel there? Is it metal?
It's metal. I'm trying to remember what type of metal, but it's
like tin or
it's
something.
Like, yeah, some sort. It's actually relatively thin, but it's a sheet steel kind of copper.
It's been etched and somehow. Yeah. It's really nice.
Has a beautiful, almost a patina-like kind of thick quality to
for
it.
For sure.
Gorgeous.
But yeah, that's where the bar came from. Found the bar, and then everything else. You know.
And then
spines.
What about these? There are these big hunks of tree
of earth on the wall.
Yeah, hanging on the wall. I thought maybe when I first saw it was, are we supposed to put hats on that? Or
You could. So those actually sat in my backyard for probably 4 or 5 years, but they were, and I tried to convince my wife before we opened Cassatt to do the same thing on my walls, but she just wasn't convinced yet. And now she sees it in the restaurant. She's like, oh man, I should have put that in her house. Well, he had years to do it. But they, basically they're old vines. They're also 100 plus year old vines, Grenache Gris vines from good friend and former sommelier at Pago, Evan Lewandowski. So he makes Ruth Lewandowski wines. They just have a little bit left in the state from this current spring order. But yeah, he gave it to me as a gift. I helped him. He was working at Pago on 9th, and I was helping him with his business plan and trying to assist, and he gave those to me as a gift for helping him with his path.
Well, yeah, when you say vines, people, I think, maybe picture, you know, like
little thin
grapevines. These are like tree trunks.
Yeah.
They're grapevines, but they're like tree trunks. They're so thick. And
They're the trunk of the vine.
Yeah.
So this is what goes into the ground, and then the vines grow off of it.
And they're the older they get, the stalks are generally start getting more robust. So now they're probably like 16-inch width, you know, on the bottom, and then just really gnarly finger-looking protruding things coming off the top. And
do you have to treat them in any way, or just?
I power washed them. I took them to the car wash, and I power washed them.
To the car wash. Okay, nice.
Yeah. I was like, sorry for whoever's next.
Wow.
There's a bunch of dirt and old debris.
Cassatt, by the way, Cassatt means what? And it's C-A-S-O-T. I think I was putting two S's in it for a while.
Yeah. I choose these random names that no one understands, and there's good reason most of the time. But usually I'm inspired by something, and this particular name came from a visit to Piedmont. The joy and pleasure of my job, that's another signature of like, oh, I've at least made it enough to travel. Mm. You know, so that level of success is I love visiting wineries, visiting wine regions, the winemakers, also brewmasters, distillers, all that. But wine people are my favorite. Mm. So I was visiting some wineries in Piedmont, in northern Italy. And out of all the regions I visited in the world prior to that, I saw these little stone structures in the middle of vineyards on steep slopes. And those little stone structures have a name, and they're called Cassatt or Chibot.
And what are they for?
They're for a place of shelter and refuge for the vineyard workers. Because it's such extreme area, like climate. They'd go in there, eat their lunch, drink some wine, break the bread. And all over these steep terraced vineyards in the middle of nowhere, there'd be these little stone buildings. And I loved it. So I wrote it down in my notebook. I'm going to name a restaurant or a bar this at some point. But they have so it's an interesting dialect. It's a Piedmontese dialect, so it's not even really an Italian word. So looking it up is very difficult.
Yeah, and it doesn't translate. It doesn't come up.
But the UNESCO ended up giving these little structures a World Heritage Site. Quality.
Yeah, yeah.
So pretty cool.
It's exciting, too. It's great because this place, you can come in. It opens what time?
5 o'clock.
5 o'clock in the afternoon. You can come in after work and shelter from the storm.
Yep.
You can shelter from the storms of the day.
Got the brick shelter here, and it's.
I didn't notice when I was here before. That's a garage door open.
It is, yes.
Yeah. Do you open it?
We do. Not right now because it's really hot.
Yeah. But like in a cool evening or something, people sit outside. And it's beautiful in here. It's really great. And it's a wine bar specifically, but there are craft cocktails as well.
Yeah.
And talk about the range of wine maybe that you have available here. What kind of
part of the fun for me is I like to just buy a couple cases of wines and sell them, you know, to guests, have from high end, beautiful, allocated, crazy stuff that no one ever gets to see, like Paolo Bea wines that are some of the best wines from Italy, from the high end to the low end to, you know, a really fun, fresh rosé that's $9 a glass to a $40 reserve special once a year allocation that I get. So I try to have about 50, 60 bottles on the list at a time, different brands, different labels. And I really want to share wines with people. So I don't have the list changes at least once a week. There's about 5 new wines, and that's, the special order process. And really, I prefer to keep it a small selection of wines by the glass, about 10, and just change it more frequently because I really want the wines to be fresh, and I want every guest to, you know, be able to, you know, if you come twice a month, there's going to be something you've never had before every time. And some guests come a lot more than that, which is, I prefer that. But no, that's the idea. Is
this is their neighborhood bar.
Yeah, and I consider it a natural wine bar, and the term means a lot of different things to different people. My version of what I value in natural wine is a little bit different than some people, but the general term of that is it's organic, biodynamic farming, low to zero additions into the wine, which is also low sulfur, which is the part where my threshold's a little higher than some hardcore purists that say zero. I prefer under 50 parts if people are wine people and they know that. Great. If not, you just won't notice. I want the wine to taste like wine, not funk. So I appreciate that the natural wine trend, but I'm still and I love natural wines. I'm a natural wine person, but I still want the fruit to come out and not bacterias and things like that. So I'm a little bit more of a sidebar natural wine dude, and I like classic producers, classic regions, as well as the fun, funky stuff. So as long as it still tastes like delicious, fresh wine.
Exciting.
But small producers. I like to support people rather than brands.
And what do you do for food at Cassat? There's not a kitchen.
Nope, no kitchen. We have cheese, olives, some lovely chips. And then we also do a large amount of takeout from Finca. We've developed a little takeout program where you can order online, and we have these, they're called tiffin pans. They look like little metal lunch boxes that stack on top of each other.
Oh yeah, I've seen that, yeah.
Yeah, and it's 2 to 3 tiers, and we've developed a small takeout menu that travels well, so it's delicious when it gets here. And that was, so you can get anything you want from the menu, from Finca's menu, but we curated some groups of things that we think do the best in the takeout format.
That's
which
cool.
Which is always,
and it's just right across the street. They just run it over and there you go.
Typically it's about 20 minutes unless the kitchen's rocking on a Friday and Saturday. It might be a little longer, but it's been fun. It's been working out.
Scott Evans, the founder of the Pago Restaurant Group. How many restaurants in the group now?
I think that's 5. And there's one more.
There's something new on the horizon. Yes, what are you planning?
This will be the first official words in on air in the media at all. So I took over a space on Regent Street from some friends, and we are now opening Finca Pinchos Bar. And I'll have to explain what pinchos are, I'm guessing.
How do you guess? Yes, because I'm looking puzzled. Yeah. How do you spell pinchos?
Pinchos, it's P-I-N-T-X-O.
Yeah, I'm even more confused now.
Yeah. So it's pinchos in general are small tapas. So in the Basque Country in northern Spain, you'll see a lot of things that look like bruschetta on a piece of toast, and that's that Spanish version of little small bites, and sometimes a lot of things on toothpick skewers, and they have a case that looks like a sushi case, and it's filled with all these little delicious bites. So when I walked through this space, it was formerly Fireside and Fenice. It just felt like a pincho bar. I just got back from Spain. I went to Spain again a couple months ago.
That long counter. I can see it. Yeah.
And I just love that format of it's still fresh food. You just keep filling the case. You point to what you want. You have your quick bites that satiate you, you know, and then you have a kitchen that has, you know, hot plates coming out of the kitchen as well. And I just love the concept. It's a strange, crazy word.
and there's nothing really like that in town, is there?
Nothing like that in town. And I can't tell you, there might be one or two in the country, to my knowledge. There's one that was in Barcelona that opened up in New York. I don't know if they're still open, but it's very rare, you know, to see it in the U.S. And it's also, it's all about, to me, it's just the curation. We have to do a great job of curating the right dishes, because there's some pretty obscure, fun stuff from the Basque country with, you know, baby eels and things like that that we'll have to use sparingly, because our audience won't quite
it's
know.
It's hard to get baby eel, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But they have just, you know, delicious things with, like, cheese, little sausages on a skewer. They have, you know, bocarones, all this.
When will Finca Pincho?
Pincho Bar?
Pincho Bar open.
It's scheduled to, it's with the blessing of the DABS and my health department. We're waiting for the health department to come back in this week and get our business license so we can be on the agenda for the 21st DABS meeting.
Of July.
And if we get that, we'll be open the following week.
A couple of big general questions, and then we'll move on to, I think Jimmy wants to give us some news, and we have a drinking game to play as well. But just a couple of quick general questions for Scott Evans. First of all, you are very well-spoken. I mean, you tell a story well.
Often too long, according to my wife.
Your wife and my wife should get together. Yeah. No, or she'll say to me, "Oh, you're telling this one again, huh?"
Yeah. I just got started. It's going to be different.
It's going to be different. Come on. And you know a lot about wine, and you've traveled a lot, and you've had quite an experience opening a restaurant group. Mm-hmm. How about a book?
No, I'd like to. I'd like to. That would also be a good excuse, because for me, I can't just not do stuff. I have to keep opening and creating, and I actually have some drafts of things that I think would add. Right now, I'm trying to read. I don't know who recently talked to me about this, but I want to devour everything that exists in my space and read it. You see, I want to add value if I write. So I'm trying to make sure that my stories and lessons are adding to the to some new perspective of food and beverage. And, you know, yes, my story will be woven into it, but that's really what I'm focusing on now, is like, can I add value to the restaurant space?
It's exactly what I'm talking about. You are a thoughtful person. and then finally, just, I would, what's your assessment of the restaurant scene in general in the Great Salt Lake City?
I think from, you know, from 2009 and before to now, it's thriving. It's great to see lots of room, lots of gaps, honestly, still. But, I mean, super happy with having at least 15 top restaurants that could be great anywhere and deserve the awards they're getting. Super proud of a lot of our former teammates who opened their own businesses, and I love seeing that. That's probably one of the joys. Someone asked me recently this week, what are some of the signs of your contentness or success? I'm like, when I have about five or six close friends who worked with us for years that opened their own businesses, and I love seeing them just crush it. And, you know, Scott Gardner from Water Witch and Gnome, Drew from Ochre, Dallas at Facile Taqueria. I mean, just it just keeps going. Michael, obviously, Mike Ritchie from it's just so many people that are doing great things, and I just couldn't be
It's terrific.
More
I
proud.
Mean, it is, that's one thing about the restaurant business that I think is really interesting, is that generally there's a lot of camaraderie. There's a lot of your success is my success. Go to it, brother. Go get it.
And
go
that
get it.
Didn't exist as much before 2009. To be honest, it's there was a bit more fear of competition, and I experienced it a little bit when I started. But I did my best to try to, you know, build some bridges with some people, and then all the people that had the groups before me, like Michael Trapp and Joel LaSalle and those guys. I appreciate the foundation that they laid, and I think that's what people are doing, you know, the younger guys and gals, beyond that are younger than me are doing the same thing now. Jameel Gaskin used to work for me, has a couple great restaurants, and he's growing his group and doing a great job. Like, people are just, I think that just keeps happening. We're creating more opportunities. There's gaps that I wish we had, and I think Gnome fills one of those. I feel like some of the biggest gaps are the ethnic food. Different, you know, strategic, more. I love Tekashi, one of my favorite restaurants. I wish there were like six of them, or at least six places that served good, that quality. That's an opportunity someone to do.
Can you get us an Indonesian, Indonesian restaurant somewhere? Yeah. I'd love to have rice stoffel again.
Yeah, and there's a lot of that where I think we have great ethnic food options, but they're more in the casual side. What I think is the next opportunity is just improving the ingredients a little bit, sourcing more, a little bit better quality ingredients. Yeah, the price will go up a little bit, but we have great Mexican food. But I'd love that we're like bridging the gap, and that's getting full. Yeah,
fine dining Indonesia. Mexican is.
And not necessarily fine dining, but just a little bit more intention.
Stepped up.
Just great ingredients, you know, and then a little bit more, a lot of the, around the country, you'll see people coming back to whatever their heritage was. If they're from Vietnam, they're doing Vietnamese food, but they're using their culinary training from all the great restaurants they worked at. And I look forward to more of that and what Romina's doing with the buns, that type of stuff where you have single ingredient, delicious, simple food is, I want more of that.
Yeah. Scott Evans, you see, he's got to write a book. He's thoughtful about all of this. Yeah,
I'd read it.
Now, Jimmy, you have Jimmy Santangelo. I'm Bill Allred. Do you have any news for us?
A little splash of news. Yeah, I thought it would be fun to lean into some wine news here with our guest. So I just got a couple bullet points here. Ocean's 11 style break-in at a top LA wine and liquor store, Lincoln Fine Wines, in Venice, California. A thief reportedly got away with top bottles of Petrus and a $6,000 bottle of The Last Drop Scotch. They say over $600,000 total in retail.
$600,000.
$600,000. Four hours.
I wonder how many bottles of stuff that was.
Cases and cases.
And the only, was one guy, they think?
They're not sure. They saw one guy on camera. There was a pickup truck, and he dropped down through the ceiling,
It
was Tom Cruise. The Mission Impossible.
They're trying to promote the movie, aren't they?
Yeah, that's one way to do it. Yeah. There's another Egyptian king Tutankhamen. This
is
a fun
first
one.
I think
A fun week has also learned that Egyptian King Tutankhamen may have died in a drinking driving crash with excessive white wine consumption combined with an ill-advised spin in the royal chariot, given as a major theory behind the famous monarch's demise. This is winebusiness.com, people. Check it. Yeah. There's also a top sommelier jailed on selling wine. Our friend Guillermo Cruz, named best sommelier in Spain in 2014, and former sommelier top two Michelin-starred Mugares Hotel just outside of San Sebastian, has been found guilty of theft and illegally selling wines for the restaurant in which he worked. So he was ordering the restaurants for the restaurant, didn't have to pay for it, sold them. Wow. On his own, and then pocketed the change.
That's
two years.
I hope none of Scott's employees are hearing this.
Sentence and 24 grand to pay back. Here's something that's interesting. Talk about sustainability and natural wines. The EU, European Union, anti-pesticide proposal strikes fear into wine sector. So the proposal is to reduce pesticides use across European Union. This has struck fear into representatives of the wine sector in numerous member states, because they're feeling like there's going to be a drop in yields associated with the with the move. So less fruit, less wine, less wine, less money, less revenue. So I think it will, though, as I would imagine, Scott, you would think it's only going to improve quality.
Yeah, in general.
Yeah.
You're in favor of the no pesticides or as few as possible.
And
this is
like,
reduce.
I think it's one of the biggest things I found fascinating is people. Most of our guests are very aware of pesticides in food, but they don't think about it in beverages. And wine is a crop. It's a grape. So if you have an apple and put pesticides on it and you wouldn't buy that, you go to a store, get organic apples, you really should be considering what chemicals are in the wine. And that's probably my number one reason for supporting that movement is, it's still food.
Are we going to do this now, Jimmy?
And one last one. Okay. I just got to read this. World's smallest wine glass made in Sweden. A Swedish company has managed to make a wine glass via a special 3D printing technique. And this is in the form of a goblet. It is, let's see here, the glass can only be seen through an electron microscope, and it's narrower than a human hair. So putting new meaning into just one.
All right. Now.
And that's your splash of news.
Now, Jimmy, we go into. This is all Jimmy's idea, by the way, and we're kicking it off.
I used to do this in a pre-shift. So as a sommelier, you'd have to do pre-shift each evening, and I would get some church nods. People just, you know, zonking out during pre-shift, not paying attention. So I use these combination wine cards and sex cards as a way to spice it up. Now, mind you, this would never be able to happen today. A little thin-skinned.
Yeah. I'm not sure it should happen here.
Grapes out there. Yeah.
Well,
perhaps
so,
not. Perhaps
so
not.
So what do you want to do here? What am I doing?
So you're looking...
I've looked at some of these, and you want
to... it aloud. It's for Scott and I to answer, or you can just ask the guest directly.
A wine card or a sex card or both?
That,
you want one of each?
Yeah, do a couple, whatever you feel is comfortable.
Okay, let me see here. Okay. In 2002, this is a sex question.
Mm-hmm. Last time I had, okay. In 2002, that was okay, the last time
you had sex. Which percent of American adults said that they had watched an X-rated movie in the past year? Which percent? Here are your choices. 5%, 15%, 25%, or 35%.
That's a tight range right there. Which, what do you think?
Yeah. I feel like it depends if it's public information after you answer the question.
So watching X-rated.
I know.
So watching X-rated was the internet as, I don't want to overthink this, but it's kind of 15-ish? What do you think?
Yeah. I go lower? A little higher.
You go a little higher. Yeah, okay.
I don't know why. Well, one of my undergrad studies was sociology, so we talked a lot about that industry. Mm. And it was the actual amount that people that have observed it was much greater than that.
Than you would have thought.
So I thought it would be greater than the 35%.
It's actually, let's see, the largest was 35. It's 25% according to this. 25%.
Right. One-fourth of people.
Porn producers create about 11,000 films each year. Most go straight to video compared to only 400 mainstream Hollywood films each year. So there's a lot of porn to choose from.
Small fun fact. I won't tell you where this comes from, but one of the top guests of one of the fine hotels in Deer Valley and got all his money from the porn business.
Oh,
and
really?
He's the guy that's buying all of the top wines. Because talking to Sam's like, oh yeah, we have this one guy who made a lot of money. He finally told us he got all of his money from the porn business, and now he's buying every $6,000 bottle on their menu.
I don't know if it's the famous. There was a famous pornographic film actor in Park City for years. I don't know if he's still around.
I think he passed away.
He was a real estate agent, Harry Reams.
Harry Reams. I served him when I was a server at Stein's.
Apparently he was a really nice guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Big tipper.
Yeah. Wait a minute. Okay. We'll do a wine question. Let's see. Let me find a wine question here. Okay. What does... you guys will both. No, you'll know that. I don't know it, but you'll know it. You guys are both wine people that you'll know all of these. This is a wine question. What is a Languedoc? Is it a grape often used in the Loire Valley? Is it a region in southern France? Is it a French table wine? Or is it a second growth chateau in Bordeaux? Languedoc.
It's a region in the west.
See, you guys know.
On those easy ones, we probably don't need an ABC. We just
ask the question.
Okay, we'll just
ask the question. Yeah.
True or false? In a restaurant, it's appropriate to send back a bottle of wine you just don't like.
Oh, false! It's not that you don't like it. It's got to be a fault to it.
And I'll challenge that.
Okay.
And not because I don't disagree with, I agree with you.
No, your perspective,
My perspective is that's not the reason you should send it back, but you can. But you have to be able to communicate what it is you don't like about the wine.
Mm-hmm.
You can't be flippant. And if you do it more than once, you're not going to get served again. But if you generally don't like a wine on our list, because I serve some wines that people have never heard of, or
and they're challenging.
Out
of their zone
because it's outside. They don't understand what they're getting into. Yeah. It's a little too funky. There's nothing wrong with the wine. It's just like this is not.
Yeah,
okay. And you'll
fair enough.
I tell my team 100% don't challenge them unless they're assholes, and then it's like, well, you know, you're just being. People do that, unfortunately.
Yeah.
They buy the most, a couple hundred dollar bottle of wine and send it back. Oh, I don't really like it. I'm like, well. Sorry.
I think we've only sent back a bottle of wine maybe one time, and all the time I've been dining, and my wife said, This is vinegar.
Yeah.
It's gone. It's over.
Yeah.
And I went, oh, I thought it was supposed to taste like this.
Yeah.
She said, no, no. And the server came over. I don't remember if it was a sommelier or just a server, and went, oh, yeah, this is no good.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry.
And
we'll
replace it right away. And
for sure.
If a wine, and now the official answer is, if the wine is flawed, that is corked, oxidized, or spoiled, you should send it back. But according to famed wine expert Andrea Immer, if you select it and simply don't like it, it is not appropriate to send it back.
That's true. So that's, I think that's a nuanced answer.
Yeah. Was it Immer, the first female master?
Yeah, master.
Yeah, first female master.
And then one final question, a porn question. Who made history as the first U.S. performer to bare her breasts while dancing at a bar? So it's porn and beverage. It's
okay.
Say, yeah.
So it's, and I think I know the answer to this. Is it A, Carol Doda, B, Mae West, C, Gypsy Rose Lee, or D, Raven Sterling?
It would be an absolute guess. I only recognize Mae West as a name. Maybe the C, but I'm not sure. What do you think, Bill?
I just looked at the answer, and that was my answer.
It was your guess?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Carol Doda.
Carol Doda.
Yeah, I would have been wrong.
Carol Doda, and because I saw her once.
Oh.
Carol Doda, credited with first public topless performance when she danced on a white baby grand piano at San Francisco's Condor Club in 1964. Doda got her fame in lights when her breasts became part of the city's neon skyline. She also won the Business Person of the Year award from a Harvard University asset management course.
Wow.
But she was the first performer to go big with implants, and I mean she had like 40,
so she had some assets.
She really and she was a lovely, I saw her once and she was lovely, except her breasts were just too damn big. And apparently she was a lovely person, and everybody in San Francisco that knew her loved her, and anyway,
oh my god!
So there you go.
Well, thank you, and that's our.
Is that how that's supposed to work?
Fun facts.
All right,
right
well
there.
Done.
Fun facts.
I think that's it.
I think so. Scott, thank you so much for joining us, talking about the restaurant group. You and I have been friends. You've welcomed me with open arms the moment I got back here into town, and you've been part of my business success. So thank you from me to you.
Of course. I should have put you on that list of you started WSET out of Pago 9th and 9th.
Yeah.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, the wine certification. My first time I ever certified somebody in the state of Utah was with Pago, and Scotty opened up his, as he has here today. He's been like that since day one.
Scott Evans, founder of the Pago Restaurant Group, which includes Pago on 9th, Pago on Main, Finca, Emigration Cafe, of course, Cassatt, and coming soon, Finca Pinto.
Pincho Bar.
Pincho
Bar.
Pincho Bar. Finca Pincho Bar.
Gentlemen, cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of the Let's Go Eat and Drink Show with Jimmy Santangelo and Bill Allred. Comments, questions, or angry complaints to the management should be directed to the Let's Go Eat Show at gmail.com. The Let's Go Eat and Drink Show is produced by Dawson Dow. The Let's Go Eat and Drink theme was composed and performed by Doug Wild. I'm Zach Caton. So long, I love you, and you haven't seen the last of me. Let's go.